Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with stunning revelations by the former acting director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, in an interview on 60 Minutes, where he discussed his new book, The Threat, How the FBI Protects America in the Age of Terror and Trump. With the book revealing that Trump believes what Putin tells him and not his own intelligence officials who are telling him otherwise, McCabe joins a line of former top intelligence officials such as FBI Director Comey, DNI, Clapper, CIA Director Brennan, and CIA and NSA Director Hayden, all of whom have gone public warning Americans that their president is possibly a traitor because of his peculiarly deferential relationship with Putin, the leader of the country's main adversary. Craig Unger, who has written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair, and is the author of the new book House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia, joins us to discuss how the evidence that Trump is both a criminal and a traitor is piling up before our eyes. And while Trump tweets indignation at McCabe's, quote, illegal and treasonous behavior and quote, illegal coup attempt, which Senator Lindsey Graham joins the chorus calling for a Senate investigation of McCabe, not Trump. The surreal nature of the growing weight of evidence versus the diminishing credibility of denial should be apparent to all, but not so if you watch Fox News. Then we'll examine the devastating report on fake news from the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Committee of the UK Parliament, which slams Facebook as a digital gangster destroying democracy and accuses its CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, of pursuing, quote, a deliberate strategy of deceiving Parliament. Siva Vaidyanathan, Professor of Media Studies and Director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia and author of Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy, joins us to discuss how Senator Schumer is making sure Facebook does not face a similar probe in the United States. Then finally, we will speak with Corey Pine, an investigative reporter who did a deep dive into the greed and hubris of Silicon Valley, emerging with a scathing, sardonic expose of tech culture in his new book, Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley. He joins us to discuss the dystopian reality of a tech industry which sold us on a utopian future and the techno-oligarchy of short-sighted reactionary titans atop the world's most powerful corporations, amassing vast fortunes at the cost of the common good. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, and the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He's written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair, and his new book is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Unger.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thank you for joining us. And the former acting director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, was on 60 Minutes, and it obviously got a lot of people's attention, particularly Donald Trump's attention. He's been tweeting out furiously and angrily talking about McCabe being engaged in illegal and treasonous behavior and that the whole thing was an illegal coup attempt. And Senator Lindsey Graham has joined in the chorus calling for an investigation, not into Trump, but into McCabe. This whole thing is surreal because your book, which is heavily footnoted, paints an extraordinarily clear picture of a president who is both a criminal and a traitor, and many other very, very fine journalists like yourself have done the same. And we have McCabe joining a long line of the former top intelligence officials of this country. Comey, the head of the FBI, the director of national intelligence, James Clapper, the former head of the CIA, John Brennan, the former head of the National Security Agency and the CIA, General Hayden. They've all joined in this chorus warning us about our president and his relationship with the main adversary led by Vladimir Putin. So what's going on here? On the one hand, you have the evidence piling up against Trump, and on the other hand, you've got his denials diminishing in credibility, and yet somehow or other, 40% of the American people simply don't believe what's staring them in the face.
No, it's absolutely amazing. And you know, the truth is almost every, maybe not every one of the people you mentioned, but most of them, let's remember, they're Republicans. McCabe was a Republican. Comey was a Republican. Mueller, of course, has not been speaking out, but he's investigating this and is the target of a lot of Trump's vitriol, and he is a Republican. So the Republicans who are sticking with Trump are they tend to be elected officials, and as I show in my book, a lot of them are on the receiving end of a lot of that Russian money. A big part of the scandal, I think, is that it's been going on for many, many years, and the Russians sort of figured out how to use our electoral finance system and so forth to send money into the Republican Party. You have at least one of the oligarchs, Leonard Blavatnik, is a naturalized American citizen, so he could send huge amounts of money into the super PACs that funded Republicans. We had money going into the National Rifle Association from the Republicans and that from Russia, and that also goes into Republicans. So this is a massive, massive scandal.
Well, so when Kevin McCarthy, who is now the minority leader of the House, the Republican from Bakersfield, was in a private meeting with the former Speaker, Paul Ryan, when he said, "I swear to God, Trump and Dana Rohrabacher are on Putin's payroll." And then Paul Ryan immediately said, "Look, you know, let's not talk about this. Keep it amongst ourselves." Does that mean that they all know what's going on? They know the corruption within their own party?
I think an awful lot of them do. That incident, as you say, I think it's a really important one because it was recorded. We have a tape recording of it. And when they were first asked about it, I believe it was Kevin McCarthy's office said, "Oh, it doesn't exist." Then he told there was a tape recording. So they said, "Oh, it's a joke." Well, when you read the entire transcript and the context of it, you know this is no joke. And at the time, Paul Ryan and Kevin McCarthy and a lot of the top Republicans had just met with the new leader of Ukraine, who was telling them all about the interference, how they were being threatened by Russia, that there was all the Russian mafia had corrupted everything entirely. And Paul Ryan went on to say that, you know, and we're standing behind them. And of course, Representative Kathy Rogers, who was the leading woman Republican, was part of that group. And she said, "Are you out of your mind? We're not standing behind Ukraine." And that's when Kevin McCarthy chimed in with saying, "I'll bet they're all on Putin's payroll." And he meant it quite seriously. You can tell by the context. So certainly a lot of them know about it. And they must know about the money going through the National Rifle Association, through the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. This has been going on for years. And I take you back into the 90s with people like then Speaker of the House Tom DeLay running off to Moscow when he needed some money.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, and the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He's written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair, and his new book is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Well, my sense is, Craig, that Senator McCain, who was very much the sort of mentor of Senator Lindsey Graham, they were very close friends. He must be turning over his grave at the apologist for Trump as the evidence mounts. I mean, the recounting by McCabe of the FBI briefer along with the other top intelligence briefers telling Trump about the threat from North Korea and that they had intercontinental ballistic missiles that could reach the United States. And then Trump says, oh, no, that's not true. Putin told me that they don't have those missiles. And the intelligence chief says, yeah, but we're telling you that he does. And Trump says, oh, I don't believe you guys. I believe Putin. So when we saw it on display in Helsinki that he believes Putin, Putin's denials about interfering in the election and not the intelligence community that's saying the opposite. So the evidence is out there. So you must be frustrated because you've delivered so much evidence in your book and others, as I mentioned, have as well. What is going on here? What do you think is this wall that we're up against?
Well, it is amazing. There's that 40%, 35 or 40% of the country who seems to be sticking with Trump no matter what. And you have, just enormous support for Trump among elected Republican officials. That has started to waver a bit when he, during the government shutdown, I believe there were six Republican senators who were sort of wavering, which would have given a majority to the Democrats in the Senate. And you can see things that may start to break with this declaration of this phony emergency. The only emergency we have is that Donald Trump is in the White House. I mean, the idea that we're under attack from our southern border, from a caravan from Honduras is sort of ridiculous. And Trump made that very, very clear himself inadvertently when he said, I didn't have to do this now. That's not the way you talk about an emergency.
So McCabe's obviously, I don't think the people who watch Fox News are going to read McCabe's book. That's a given. But there's got to be enough people in this country, and he's a minority president in any case. What can the majority do as it dawns on them? And I know it's hard to get your head around the idea that your president, the one that was elected, is both a criminal and a traitor. That's a really hard thing to get your head around. But assuming that eventually people will come to that conclusion, and whether that will come from the Mueller report or not, as I say, there's enough evidence out there to make that case. And the more I talk, and you do, I know you do too, Craig, to intelligence officials, the more, it's just a matter of fact in that world. They all know that this is who he is. He's been this way forever, going back to Roy Cohn, going back to the early stuff that you point out in your book, where Russian gangsters plonked $6 million of cash down and bought a bunch of condos in Trump Tower, and eventually bought $100 million worth of condos in Trump Tower and started a weekly poker game where they let him win and had all these scantily clad Russian girls waiting on him hand and foot. I mean, that's just the beginning of the saga, you know?
Right. So, no, and as you say, I mean, these high-level people like John Brennan and Clapper are not the kind of people, they don't shoot their mouths off easily. They are coming forward as a matter of patriotism, and these are not left-wing people, these are not particularly liberals, but they see a clear and present danger in having Donald Trump in the White House. He is our national security threat.
So we've tried to figure out why the Republicans are turning a blind eye willfully when a lot of them know what's really going on here. And what's going on here is incredibly alarming, and it flies in the face of their traditional red-baiting and Soviet-hating. But on the left, you've got the editors of The Nation and Glenn Greenwald and a bunch of others who just will not accept the obvious, and that's one of the tragedies of the American left. The American left used to, be against these third world dictators that the U.S. was propping up, like Somoza and the horrible junta in El Salvador and throughout the entire Cold War. And now the American left is making excuses for the very same kind of gangsters and kleptocrats.
Right. And I you see with WikiLeaks, of course, part of that comes, I think, from WikiLeaks is that you have people like Greenwald who identified with WikiLeaks and so forth. And their relationships became that became a huge part of his career. And of course, WikiLeaks, it may not have started out this way, but over time it became very much a tool that the Russians were using.
So as I say, you've got problems on the, both the left and the right in terms of denial, but you've got the majority waking up, the evidence is piling up. At what point does the dam break? Do you think it requires the Mueller investigation to go public?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I don't think that's the entire thing. And a bit, one thing I've been looking forward to, and it's been delayed again and again, is Adam Schiff and the House Intelligence Committee having hearings. And, of course, when the Republicans were in charge, people like Adam Schiff were completely thwarted by Devin Nunes, who was effectively acting as an obstructionist on behalf of the Trump White House. Now we have Adam Schiff in charge, and I think we're going to see very, very different things. And the Republicans have been trying to delay it for quite some time. And they even delayed appointing members to the committee just to keep Schiff from having hearings for a while. But last week it finally got underway, and one of the first things they did that the House Intelligence Committee did under the directorship of the Democrats was to deliver to Robert Mueller the transcripts of 19 different people who were testified behind closed doors. And those included the testimonies of Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. and people like that. So that testimony was very important for Mueller if he wants to file charges on perjury, for example, against them. It's great to have that sworn testimony. He really needed that, and the Republicans have been delaying again and again. And I think now we should have televised hearings, and we need that. We need nationally televised hearings. I think a big part of our problem has been that the media is so fragmented, it's so atomized. Everyone is in their own little silo. And I appear on MSNBC fairly frequently. But you know what? There are more than 300 million people who are not watching, and that never gets across to the people who watch Fox News.
Well, just in closing, the new Attorney General, Barr, there's some suspicion about him not wanting the Mueller report necessarily to go public. But now he already has a crisis on his hands. He has to choose whether he believes or supports Rosenstein and McCabe or Trump and Lindsey Graham. So what do you think is going to happen there?
Well, I'm certainly wary of William Barr, and he has a history that makes me very, very nervous, and he's been promoting this unitary executive and all that. At the same time, I'm really not sure how he's going to act in this. I suspect in the end he's going to do what's best for William Barr. And he may end up thinking he can make a better career for himself by saving the nation from Donald Trump. For all I know, I don't know how this is going to play out. He could go either way.
Well, Craig Unger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, and the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He's written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair, and his new book is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the devastating report on fake news from the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Committee of the UK Parliament, which slams Facebook as a digital gangster destroying democracy.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Siva Vaidyanathan, Professor of Media Studies and Director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. And his latest book is Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Siva Vaidyanathan.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
Well, thank you. And the report that's come out of the British Parliament, initially investigating Cambridge Analytica and then moving on to investigate Facebook because of the connections that emerged from the investigation into Cambridge Analytica and its effect on both Brexit and, by extension, the U.S. presidential elections. Some of the quotes are just absolutely damning. The report says Facebook behaves like a digital gangster. It considers itself ahead of and beyond the law. It misled the UK Parliament, and that giving statements that were not true, and that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has treated British parliamentarians with contempt, and pursuing a deliberate strategy to deceive Parliament. I understand there have been investigations here in the United States, but as far as I remember, nothing quite as stinging as this report from the UK Parliament.
We have. I mean, we have had active investigations both in the House and the Senate, and the Federal Trade Commission in the United States is doing extensive work trying to figure out exactly to what extent Facebook has violated its own promises to the FTC that it made back in 2011, that it would not share our data with third parties like Cambridge Analytica without our permission. Now, clearly, Facebook has violated that, what's called a consent decree. So there are a number of efforts in the United States to get to the bottom of what Facebook has been doing, the ways it has been abrogating trust, the ways it has been violating its own agreements with the government, the ways that it has been violating its own promises to users, and the ways in which it's created a tremendous amount of pressure on our ability to govern ourselves. So, but we haven't seen a firm report or statement or set of conclusions or recommendations like we see today out of the UK. That, I think, is the difference. In the UK, they were much more willing to come down hard on Facebook and propose very stern regulatory responses, whereas in the United States, we have two problems. Number one, Facebook has actually been a lot more openly cooperative, at least in public, than it has been in the UK. Facebook executives have appeared before Congress. Facebook lawyers have been interacting with the FTC regularly. So this notion that one of the things that really offended the parliamentary investigators was the extent to which Facebook demonstrated hubris throughout the entire process, assuming that the UK government didn't understand or didn't really mean to look into these issues with any, strong commitment to getting to the bottom of them. So, basically what you have here is Facebook toward the public and toward Washington trying to exhibit contrition, a little bit of sorrow or apologies toward all of these terrible actions over the past few years, but in the UK, exhibiting purely hubris.
Well, one of the points in the report, Siva, is that there's a reference to the Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, known as RICO, which we know is a U.S. law designed to tackle the mafia and organized crime. What were they getting at there, do you think?
You know, it's unclear to me the extent to which British investigators could attach the accusation of racketeering to Facebook, largely because much of what happens on Facebook occurs in the dark to Facebook itself. In other words, Facebook is so big compared to its ability to the company's ability to govern what happens on Facebook. Facebook has 2.3 billion users around the world, constantly uploading video and text and images, in more than 100 languages. And Facebook, it has long been arrogant enough to keep its staff small so that it grew very large with a very small staff, one of the best ways to run a profit, one of the worst ways to maintain control of your system, integrity of your system, security of your system. So from my point of view, Facebook has engaged in the sort of malpractice, but not malfeasance necessarily, although there may be examples of malfeasance that I have not been made aware of. The idea of racketeering, of course, takes intentionality a few degrees away. One can participate in and profit from a criminal activity, like perhaps what Cambridge Analytica did, and still be several degrees away and not necessarily have to demonstrate intentionality or intent, right? But I think that from the point of view of the United States, I can't imagine a prosecutor in the United States taking racketeering seriously as a charge for Facebook, based on what we know now. But, you know, I just think that that shows the extent to which Facebook has tried the patience of regulators and legislators in the United Kingdom. And I have to say that that opinion, the low opinion of Facebook and its leadership, is shared everywhere in the world except certain corners of Washington, D.C. Facebook has very powerful supporters in Washington, D.C. And ultimately, that is what is going to stave off any serious regulatory efforts here in the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with Asiva Vidyanathan, who's a professor of media studies and director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. His latest book is Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. But with all of the political support that Facebook could buy, and of course we know that Google's Eric Schmidt had more visits to the Obama White House than any other single person, we know that these big tech companies have clout in Washington. But they've also got a lot of enemies, don't they? I mean, the entire media business is being driven out of business, the news business. You've got McClatchy, Vice, Huffington Post, BuzzFeed laying off reporters in droves, because 90% of the digital dollars go to Google and Facebook. So are there any countervailing lobbying efforts underway on our lawmakers to point out that essentially Facebook and Google are destroying the news business?
The countervailing lobbying power to Facebook and Google include the other companies that want to do similar advertising in the world and build similar advertising systems. And that means Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast mostly. Those telecommunication companies have generally been the rivals of Facebook and Google. They have gone head to head on the issue of network neutrality, whether those companies should be able to discriminate how data flows between and among different services to alter what we experience through our phones and computers. That's been a big issue where Google and Facebook have supported network neutrality, and the telecom companies want to be able to control everything that goes on in our lives, so they want to end network neutrality. And, of course, those companies also would love to build targeted advertising systems much like Facebook and Google have. So far, they are far behind, but they are doing their best to build them. So any regulatory effort that cracks down on targeted advertising and the data surveillance that these companies need is not going to fly. Anything that reduces the ability of Facebook and Google to execute those plans also reduces the ability of Verizon and Comcast and AT&T. So we're not likely to see anything in the area of data protection the way that Europe has. So I'm afraid that's out of the question. But in terms of the overall ability to perhaps break up Facebook and Google or limit their ability to acquire new firms in the future, in that case, countervailing powers can matter. Countervailing powers like the telecoms that are going to exercise their best efforts on Capitol Hill to make sure that Facebook and Google don't get more powerful.
But when you talk about their arrogance, which is certainly what the British parliamentary report from the committee called Digital Culture, Media and Sports Committee of the UK Parliament, their hubris is made very clear by this report. But how different is that Or is it similar, for example, to the hubris that Amazon is displaying by basically telling New York, well, you know, screw you?
You know, there is a certain stylistic continuity between the hubris of an Amazon and the hubris of a Google or a Facebook. You know, they all have emerged in this age in which the ideas of democratic states seem quaint. The notion of fast moving tech companies run by visionaries seems so much more attractive. And therefore, it makes it seem like we should defer to the judgment of these tech geniuses. But I think we've seen plenty of examples in recent years that these leaders are going to fly too close to the sun. Have already flown too close to the sun and will ultimately be punished for the hubris in some way. I'm just not confident they will be punished for the hubris in the United States in any way that resembles effective regulation.
Well, specifically, though, the British parliamentary inquiry was in looking into fake news and the impact it's had. And clearly there are indications, not just from the inquiry into Cambridge Analytica, but there's this character, Aaron Banks, who seems to have been funded via his Russian wife from the Kremlin or other shady Russian operations. So there's obviously still more investigating to be done on the UK side. But I don't see a similar inquiry in this country, specifically into fake news itself and this phenomenon, because there's two sides of fake news. There's the President Trump's side, where if he gets a question from the White House reporters, particularly CNN, that he doesn't like, he immediately dismisses the question as the reporter being a representative of fake news. So, fake news in this country is very much in the eye of the beholder.
Well, that's why I don't use the term. It's one of the reasons I don't use the term. I think it's an incoherent term. It's also incomplete. It doesn't actually describe the problem. If you look at the big problem with the interference in the Brexit election or the interference in the United States elections in 2016, the problem had to do with the distribution of a variety of forms of propaganda, disinformation, misinformation, malinformation, conspiracy theories, sly pokes at the seams of American society. This notion that you would just run things out that are demonstrably false, that's pretty trivial in the whole scheme of things. The real question had to do with the process of targeting and moving and splitting and inspiring or deflating enthusiasm for certain ideas, candidates, and movements, a very complex process that seemed to have been orchestrated from St. Petersburg in many cases, right? And with the help of certain important figures and campaigns in the United States and the UK, for instance, Leave, or at least some elements of the Leave campaign in the UK and the Donald Trump campaign here in the United States, as well as the National Rifle Association. So there is a very interesting pattern of interference that we need to make sense of. But it's also important to remember that the very fact of the attempted interference is the problem in itself, and not necessarily anything that we can numerically show flipped an election. You know, the very existence of this campaign is a problem. But beyond that, we have to understand that, let's also remember that the Senate Intelligence Committee in the U.S. has been doing just this kind of investigation for 2 years now. And the staff has been very much on top of trying to figure out the extent of Russian interference, the ways in which Facebook and to a lesser extent Twitter has been contributing to it, the ways that the Russians have been exploiting fissures in American society. So the Senate Intelligence Committee is very much on top of this. And my senator Mark Warner has been, and his staff have been chiefly responsible for holding Facebook to account. Whether that actually results in a Stern report or proposed legislation, I seriously doubt. And it has nothing to do with the committee or with Senator Warner. It has to do with Senator Warner's superior in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, the minority leader of the Senate, the leading Democrat in the Senate, who is Facebook's biggest supporter. He is the largest recipient of money from Facebook, and his daughter happens to work for Facebook. He has no interest in having Facebook held to account in this country. That is why we're ultimately unlikely to see anything significant out of this country, not because there are not people in the Senate and staff in the Senate who are trying their best. It's just that Schumer's going to block everything. And he's already basically done that. He's already warned my Senator Mark Warner that nothing should come of this investigation. So basically, the United States is incapable of governing itself, just as Facebook is incapable of governing itself. And that's largely because of the deep well of corruption that we have in this country. That's a fundamental problem. It's a problem that Facebook will benefit from greatly. However, we can hope that our friends in Brussels, our friends in London, our friends in Canberra might take this much more seriously. Our friends in Ottawa should be taking it much more seriously. If we can generate enough pressure from other major wealthy markets, then we have a chance to see Facebook alter its core functions. But otherwise, I'm not optimistic.
Well, it's not just Facebook. The report does indicate that disinformation was also spread on Twitter. But one of the most amazing findings that came out when the interim report was published a month or so ago, or a little while back, just following the publication of the interim report, it found that 63% of the views of the UK online government response were from foreign internet IP addresses, with more than half of which were from Russia. So there were more people looking at the interim report in Russia than there were in the UK. So what does that tell you?
I'm not sure what to make of that. I really don't. It's kind of a bizarre situation. I would say, but though, comparing Twitter and Facebook, it's really important to remember that the scale of Twitter and the scale of Facebook, they're not even comparable. Facebook is so much bigger, so much more influential around the world. 2.3 billion people use Facebook every month. Only 300 million people use Twitter every month. Those people are largely concentrated in the global north, and Twitter's not available in as many languages. Whereas, as I said, Facebook is available in more than 100 languages. Twitter is just not a factor in some really crucial parts of the world, such as, you know, it's not a factor in Brazil. It's not a factor in India. It's not a factor in Bangladesh. It's not much of a factor in the Philippines. Whereas in most of those countries, Facebook and its other applications like WhatsApp are tremendously important and influential.
Well, Siva Vaidyanathan, I thank you very much for joining us. We'll stay in touch, I hope, because, again, I keep repeating this, but it's worth noting that these tech companies now are the biggest companies in the world. The top five tech companies tend to be the most powerful companies, and it's only been about 10 years since they eclipsed well-known companies like ExxonMobil. And if they've grown that much in such a short period of time, we can only assume that they're going to grow to be even more powerful than they are now.
That's right. Our concern with democracy has to go beyond the content that flows over these networks, as important as that is, but also to the overall political power that companies that wealthy and that significant have in our lives.
Well, again, I've been speaking with Siva Vaidyanathan, who is a professor of media studies and director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. His latest book is Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. Thanks again for joining us, Siva.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the dystopian reality of Silicon Valley and its reactionary titans atop the world's most powerful corporations amassing vast fortunes at the cost of the common good.
press it, snap it, work it, quick, erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip, unzip it, lock it, fill it, call it, find it, view it, code it, jump and lock it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, ring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it. Technologic.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Corey Pine, an investigative reporter and a regular contributor to The Baffler, who has also written for Slate, Salon, Foreign Policy, The American Prospect, and the Columbia Journalism Review. He's the author of Live, Work, 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 Die. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Pine.
Happy to be here, Ian. Thanks.
So you have encapsulated life in Silicon Valley, live, work, 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 die. But I guess all of those people up there, 99% of them, want to be like Zuckerberg, don't they? Isn't there this lure of you can become an overnight billionaire?
That's a large part of the subject of the book is what the big tech has done to San Francisco and the Bay Area in general. And I go on quite a bit using real-life examples of entrepreneurs that I interviewed and embedded myself with who were really toiling in miserable conditions with the misperception, the Horatio Alger dream of, yes, turning their poorly thought-out startup or knockoff idea into the next Facebook. And I show through many other examples that what makes the big winners in Silicon Valley is not necessarily the strength of their tech or their innovations, but rather the usual stuff, you know, winning the birth lottery, political connections, and often finding loopholes in the law to promote services that undermine, you know, existing regulations and take advantage of workers.
And what's the role of VC, venture capital?
Venture capital is the juice that keeps Silicon Valley running. It's shorthand for a type of investment that casts a wide net, you know, expecting to lose money on many investments, in this case tech startups, in the hope that one will hit it big and make up for all the rest. So that's the philosophy of the finance that drives tech, and it produces some really perverse outcomes, not only in terms of what it means to work at a company that's funded by venture capital, but what it does to the rest of the economy. You see a lot of new startups that are really pushing to disrupt other industries. There's an assumption in Silicon Valley that that's automatically going to be a good thing, but the practical effect is that it often leaves Main Street devastated and ends up being worse for not only workers but consumers, because the goal of a VC is to back a company that will become a monopoly in its niche.
So why do you think that so many people think of these Silicon Valley entrepreneurs as being liberal when they're anti-union, anti-trade unions? You know, they don't want Uber and Lyft and all these other gig economy operations are all designed to make people think that you are an entrepreneur, when in fact you have no benefits. And then you've got, obviously, for example, I mentioned Zuckerberg. You know who Zuckerberg's mentor is? Rupert Murdoch, hardly a liberal. So,
well,
what's
going
on?
You look at some of the other characters on his board, like Peter Thiel, and they're outright anti-democratic reactionaries.
Well, just explain that further, because Peter Thiel is a very prominent player in the Trump campaign. He spoke at the Republican convention. So what's describe his politics?
Peter Thiel is, you know, I would like to hear Peter Thiel describe his politics a little more frankly. This is another element of the book. I do go into the politics of these founders, particularly some of the more extreme right ones, such as Peter Thiel, who, as you noted, was a key Trump supporter, promoted Trump at the Republican National Convention back in the 2016 election. And in my book, I describe some connections he has to what I can only call a proto-fascist underground online of alt-right bloggers and personalities who argue that democracy is flawed and that we would be better off in the future if we devolve sovereignty to corporations. essentially, and let them run things as in an almost feudal capacity. And they call themselves neo-reactionaries. Some of them even believe that we should bring back monarchy and aristocracy because they have a fondness for eugenics theories and other discredited science. Peter Thiel is friends and had an election watch party with one of these bloggers named Mencius Moldbug. That's his blog name. His real name is Curtis Yarvin. And also is invested in this character's startup. I'm not sure what the startup actually produces. That would be another interesting thing for Peter Thiel to elaborate on. But it has subsidized this blogger's writings and political thinking and brought a so-called red pill ideology to thousands and thousands of Americans, including young people who are now affiliated with the alt-right movement. So really dangerous kind of politics, I think. And, you know, I know there's a lot of people who listen to your show who, you know, like to keep track of the movements of the far right and also the intelligence community. I think that some of these associations call into question why Peter Thiel, Facebook board member, top Silicon Valley investor, has a security clearance to work through his contractor, Palantir, which is working on the border wall and lots of sensitive projects for the intelligence community.
And again, I'm speaking with Corey Pine, an investigative reporter and a regular contributor to The Baffler, who's also written for Slate, Salon, Foreign Policy, The American Prospect, and the Columbia Journalism Review. And he's the author of Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley. Now, obviously, Palantir, of course, is a huge CIA contractor. But Amazon also has massive contracts, the CIA and the NSA, and about to get a big one, massive one with the Department of Defense to put all of their data in the cloud. So there is obviously that relationship between these characters. But what we understand about Peter Thiel, though, is that he must believe in not the rapture, which our Secretary of State and our Vice President believe in, by the way. I believe he's kind of a survivalist, isn't he? Isn't that why he's bought a whole bunch of land in New Zealand? So that's not exactly investing in the future, is it? The idea that these people in Silicon Valley are all wonderful futurists who are going to create this halcyon future for us. He's basically got a bunker down there, hasn't he, for the end of the world?
Yeah, I think he's hedging his bets. although you mentioned Bezos, many of these tech tycoons are not outright reactionaries in the same mold as Thiel or necessarily as pessimistic as he is about the world. But many of them are transhumanists in one way or another and believe in an ideology called the singularity, which was popularized by Ray Kurzweil, the inventor and writer, in a series of books that were popular in the mid-aughts, I should say. And that is an ideology that tech is essentially creating a rapture of its own. It is delivering us to a point where humans and machines will merge and all knowledge will be united with artificial intelligence and will essentially evolve technologically into, you know, hybrid beings that live, you know, with our consciousnesses in the cloud itself. It sounds crazy, but this is a actual belief that fuels many of the most successful people in tech. Bezos spends a lot of money on life extension projects, which is also one of Thiel's hobby horses. So yeah, these people actually think that we will live forever, or perhaps they will live forever in machines. That is something they're trying to build. They differ on the details, but they want to be first. Google is another company run by people who believe in singularity. The founders have invested in a strange outfit that Kurzweil is involved in called Singularity University, which is, I believe it's just outside Palo Alto at the NASA Ames Research Center. And what can I say? This is an aspect of the Silicon Valley ideology that is still pretty poorly understood by the general public. And I think many people would be horrified if they knew more about it. That's part of the reason I wrote the book.
Well, what should get people's attention is that these companies, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, Google, and Facebook, are now among the biggest corporations in the world. You know, a decade ago, ExxonMobil dominated the world, but now Amazon and Facebook and Google do. So you can't sort of, you simply can't ignore them because of their enormous market capitalization and their extraordinary power. And we can get into some of the examples of how detrimental it's been already through the use of what's known as surveillance capitalism. But Do you think that the general public, and they certainly would get a wake-up call if they read your book, Corey Pine, but in general, do you think it's escaped the attention of a lot of people that how quickly these companies have become to dominate the global scene in terms of being the most powerful corporations on the planet? And if it's happened that quickly, if you follow the trajectory, in 10 years' time, they're going to be 10 times more powerful.
Yeah, I think that's – I agree with everything that you said. I think that part of the reason it's escaped notice is many of these tech companies are also media companies or own media companies. And traditional journalistic institutions, even major newspapers like the New York Times, depend on companies like Facebook and Google to reach their audiences more and more. And that gives these companies tremendous leverage. Jeff Bezos himself bought the Washington Post, which, you know, is one of the most important newspapers of the Trump era. The intrigue between Bezos, his mistress, American media, that whole story is another sort of troubling indication that we have an economy dominated by oligarchs. It just so happens that the tech oligarchs are the most successful. Part of that is the nature of their products, I think. You know, I talked about how they own and control media. They much of the infrastructure of communication and finance goes through tech companies now. As you alluded to, the intelligence community and the military are increasingly dependent on these companies, which we shouldn't forget began with military research. I think, you know, during the Obama years, we saw the Democratic Party essentially become very close to Silicon Valley. I think that they have distanced themselves somewhat because of the propaganda in the 2016 elections that was allowed to promulgate on Facebook and helped get Trump elected. Many Democrats in Washington are more suspicious of Silicon Valley than they used to be. At the same time, these are kingmakers, these companies, and everybody knows it. And look at the rush for governments all around the world to control and manipulate social media, because this is how people are informed now. This is where people get their ideas about how the world works. And you see intelligence services and organized crime networks, everybody exploiting this new system that we still don't understand very well. What I would like to see happen, and I don't want to jump on your next question if we're getting there eventually, but you know, I would like to see the Democrats embrace a much tougher posture toward these companies and have the threat of nationalization at least looming over their heads. Because we shouldn't forget that everything from the internet to the touchscreen that your iPhone or Android device uses was underwritten with taxpayer research. So these companies need to be reminded of their public purpose as forcefully as possible.
Well, I think the fact that Eric Schmidt, the executive at Google, had more visits to the Obama White House than any other person, I think tells a story about how the Democratic Party was seduced by these tech companies. The idea, of course, their motto, Google's motto being don't do evil. But I think things have changed, haven't they? What happened to Amazon in Queens, I think, is a big story, is it not? And, you know, you've got, on the one hand, you've got the mayor of New York and the governor of New York upset that Amazon pulled out. And you've got AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others celebrating the fact that they drove Amazon to drop this massive project, which was going to be heavily subsidized. And, of course, the argument from AOC and others is that why should we, the taxpayers, be subsidizing the world's richest company run by the world's wealthiest man?
Not only that, I think that there's a growing awareness of what tech disruption has meant for workers in terms of their wages and working conditions, but also people in any industry when it comes to the fabric of urban life. And, you know, that's where the example of the Bay Area, I think, and Seattle, you know, I'm from Washington State originally, did my reporting for this book mostly in the San Francisco area. You can see what hosting a, you know, gigantic tech company has done for those cities in terms of driving up housing prices and displacing many people who were part of the fabric of the city. At the same time, you see startups introducing apps that are supposed to make our lives easier, delivery apps, you know, ride-hailing apps. And in almost every case, the consequences of this convenience have been to turn us into something like a nation of rickshaw drivers. And it's happened very quickly. You know, the growth of part-time or casual employment, where people are picking up basically more of the costs of their own employment that used to be covered by traditional employers, has been extremely rapid, and it's somewhat expected now that if you're on the margins of the economy, you will be compensated through some very, you know, unfriendly, you know, app system. Right. So I think that the fact that that is the new reality has caused a backlash. And I think that's what we saw in New York. It wasn't just that there's increased skepticism among Democrats. People are wising up. And, you know, tech certainly doesn't have the cool and cachet it did 4 or 5 years ago when I started reporting for my book. Now it's seen as much more in the robber baron mold. And I think that is the more accurate view.
So having gone from this utopian fantasy to this dystopian reality, and that's the journey that your book takes us on, Corey Pyne, what I think is worth pointing out here in the context of the Amazon story and of this big sweepstakes where you had every city in the country begging Jeff Bezos to situate in their city and offering all kinds of goodies, and at the end they choose Queens or Long Island City in New York, and because of local pressure, they pull the plug on the deal. Now, if you're going to invent the gig economy where you turn people into rickshaw drivers, as you say, the nation of rickshaw drivers, with no pensions and no health care, you would think that these tech titans, these multi-billionaires, would at least support Medicare for all, wouldn't you? It's no skin off their back, but because of their libertarian ideology, somehow they think that the survival of the fittest, I mean, it's Darwinian in its cruelty.
Well, I think you have to look at this whole situation and this new element that tech has brought to the American system in the context of the multiple crises that the country is facing. You know, there's the political crisis of, you know, an authoritarian Republican Party. There's an ecological crisis with climate change and ecosystem collapse. There is an economic crisis that still affects many people, no matter how much, you know, the government and the media say the economy is improving. So you have to consider all of that context. And, well, you do see some of these, you know, on the spectrum of oligarchs, you do see some embracing ideas like universal basic income. I haven't heard any tech tycoon or Jeff Bezos type come out and endorse Medicare for all. I think eventually they may be pushed because of that political context into that position. And so I suppose that would be welcome. It would be something like, you know, FDR telling his capitalist class cohorts that he's actually saving the system with the New Deal. You know, we could see something like that play out. On the other hand, you hear tycoons embracing ideas like universal basic income, which would not necessarily provide people with health benefits or food benefits or things like that. It's actually a libertarian idea to do away with other social programs and safety nets and provide people a lump sum. I'm pretty skeptical of that, especially when it comes from the mouth of a corporate tycoon, because what I picture is a system where you get just enough money to spend on their products, right? Something like a return to company towns, except right. Sanctioned by the government. So I don't think that's the right answer. I do think that a return to public ownership of public infrastructure, which the internet is, and really meaningful universal social programs like a Medicare for all with a single payer component is going to do a lot more to keep the country from going off the rails. Unfortunately, you know, your first question's about venture capital. That's not how the finance sector wants things to go, you know. And the reason that they love tech companies so much is because tech companies accelerate the concentration of wealth to the elite. I mean, that's what they've done very systematically, and that's why any startup, and I talk about this in my book, any startup that helps, you know, the top 1% become the top 0.01% faster is going to get funded and going to get promoted and inflicted on the public, unfortunately.
Well, Corey Pyne, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate your book, and we'll stay in touch.
Thanks so much, Ian, and I'll make sure to pledge.
Oh, well, we would appreciate that, too. And again, I've been speaking with Corey Pyne, investigative reporter and a regular contributor to The Baffler, who's also written for Slate, Salon, Foreign Policy, The American Prospect, and the Columbia Journalism Review. And he's the author of Live, Work, 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 Die. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.